So the thought that we want is a further internalization of the universal. And Hegel thinks that the universal becoming absorbed into the self, and inclination itself becoming lawful, so there's nothing about inclinations that can't be lawful, would yield a thoroughgoing synthesis of law and inclination. And the idea of a correspondence or synthesis of law and inclination, Hegel says on page 215, is life, and as the relation of difference to one another, love. So the concept of love, which he is here borrowing from Schiller, is a unification of reason and sensibility. Love is the inclination of reason to unite or unify itself with a sensible object. In his wonderful essay on Beauty and Freedom, an essay on Schiller, not on Hegel, Dieter Henrich quotes this wonderful passage from Schiller, from the Philosophical Letters. In beauty in general, reason sees sensibility fulfilling its demand. In beauty in general, reason sees sensibility fulfilling its demands, that is, for objectivity and unity. And to its own surprise, one of its own ideas confronts it in appearance. So the surprise of beauty is something we thought belonged only to the world of ideas and reason appears. This unexpected harmony awakens a feeling of joyous approbation, and an attraction to the sensible object must result. We call this attraction benevolence, love. So love, why is love thought as a unification of inclination and reason? Well, there are three moments to the grammar of love, and in doing this, I am following an essay on love by Jean-Luc Nancy, Shattered Love. But the thought is unsurprising, because that love is inclination is not a problem. So the question is, why do we think of love as a unification of reason and inclination? Well, the first moment of the grammar of love is that all love poses itself as that which is not self-love. That is, the very experience of love, of an object, another person, anything whatsoever, poses itself as the immediate abrogation of self-love. So the experience of love is the feeling of being dispossessed of your selfishness, of your self-interest, and of finding your whole self, that is the meaning of what counts most in your life, in another. So the very thing that was supposed to cut us off from other people, namely inclination, in the case of love, actually operates in the exact opposite way. Namely, in love we experience, and experience is what I'm interested in here, grammatically, of finding our meaning or truth in the love object, right? And this, of course, can be torture, right? The beautiful cartography of this torture is Carson McCullough's Ballad of a Sad Cafe, which opens with the sentence, "The lover and beloved come from two different countries." And the whole novella, I guess, is all about how whoever is the lover does not get their love in return. So, and whoever is beloved is loves someone else, and that no one gets back what they want. So it's the lack of reciprocity. But the lack of reciprocity is what's revealing, because it reveals that love is not self-love. And that's why it is, in the case of Carson McCullough's, pure torture. Right? So it's the dwarf who loves, you know, all that. So when the other flourishes, I flourish. When the other hurts, I hurt. My life is in the other. So the very thing that the moral law thought to be a problem happens naturally. In fact, it's the first thing that happens when you're born. After hunger. It's mom, right? You're in love. When we start our life as lovers. And which is why life is miserable from there on in, right? You start as a lover, you've already lost yourself. And you never get it back. You never get it back, right? You're always outside yourself. Second moment of love. So we may say that's the moral moment of love. The second aspect, or logical aspect of love, according to Nancy, is that love is the extreme moment beyond the self of a being reaching completion. Philosophy always thinks love as an accomplishment arriving at a final and definitive completion. So the thought here is that in love, which always poses itself as not love, I also discover, I think this is what the myth of Romeo and Juliet is partially about, as complete in the other, that is, as fulfillment through the other, and therefore as lacking nothing. But if lacking nothing, if suddenly being in love is all the world and there's nothing left over, then love, as Hegel contends, neither restricts nor is restricted. This is 3045, Fragment on Love. It is not finite at all. In love, life is present as a duplicate of itself and a single and unified self. Here, life has run through the circle of development from an immature to a completely mature unity. In love, what is in principle totally outside me, if I am lucky enough to, of course, be loved in return, and that's sheer luck, which is why love is a bad model for sociality. Sheer luck. I could get far that way. We get, and why am I pounding on this notion of completion? This is Hegel's thought of an imminent absolute, of something that is not finite, but infinite. Something that is not conditioned, but unconditioned. So the very thing that metaphysicians tell us is impossible, every single one of us knows is possible and actual, namely the experience of the infinite. The infinite now, not meaning, of course, everything, but rather no exteriority. Because if my other is internal to me, and that's the crux of the matter, if my relation to myself is mediated through the other, then the other who is other, and what makes an other other, for Hegel, is two things. First, the other has free will. Why does that make the other other? Because I can kick you and coerce you and do this, but I can't make you freely will anything. I can't make you will. I can make you do things, but I can't make you freely will anything. So the one thing I can never touch of another, the one thing I can never get a hold of in any other, is their freedom. Right? And that's the entire story of being in nothingness, right? It's Sartre's thought. Right? The argument about love and sadism and masochism is all about what it is to try to touch another's freedom. You can't do it. And for the same reason, I can't touch another's desire. Right? I can dance, I can sing, I can get a haircut, I can put on aftershave lotion, and I can't make the other desire me. Right? So the other, and we're going to get deep into this, but I want to insist that what makes them, this is Hegel's idea that the other is, every other is infinitely other. And what makes them infinitely other, that is, infinitely independent of me, is I can never touch their will or their desire. Right? I can desire their desire, I can wish, want their will to desire, but I can't get it. But I can get lucky. And that's when they do desire me. And they will what I will. And then what is infinitely other is at the same time fully and completely united with me. Hence, Hegel says that life is the union of union, togetherness, and non-union, absolute difference. The absolute difference doesn't remains, which again can drive us crazy, right? Because the other can stop loving us at any moment. The other can whimsically decide, i.e., from our perspective, there's whimsical, but then it may be the most rational thing in the world. What a mistake! Now, it's seeing this logic of love is how Hegel goes from subjective to objective idealism. It's his model. It's his model. He's got to now make the model somehow work under a different description, because obviously he's now, what is he doing in this text? He's using the logic of love to interpret the structure of life. He wants to read all of life as rehearsing this logic of love, and therefore as potentially infinite in this way. And then finally, the third moment, which arguably, but I'm not going to go through the details, I'm not in this text, namely, of course, as I just said, once we go out of ourself, once we are broken into by love, we know that narcissism is a disorder, and the reason it's a disorder is because the narcissist has no exteriority. All narcissism is almost autism. Right? It's the failure being broken into, and therefore not functioning. The narcissist is an asocial beast for reason. There's nothing we can do with a narcissist because they are, as it were, totally enraptured in themselves. They are indeed pre-edible, right? They haven't even got the dyad going, right? They have collapsed the dyad into a monad. But love, so I'm saying narcissism, self-love, is no form of love at all, right? It's just a pathology of a certain kind. That seems right. Freud says it's right. But actual love, therefore, is the experience of being brokered or fractured, and we are constituted in our relation to others by this brokenness or fracturedness. In this text, Hegel does not yet have this thought in play, which is to say he does not yet have in thought the thought of negativity, which is to say he does not yet, although he says he does, have in play the relationship between love and death. And that's why the thought of death will be central to how we think about spirit, which is the replacement for love and life. Okay. So love is the model. And in order to think about that model as an alternative ethical theory, that is, an ethics without ought, Hegel wants to use the example of punishment. And the reason he wants to use the example of punishment is that punishment is trying to think about morality from the point of view of its failing. If you want to think about morality hard, don't think about the goodwill or the virtuous man. Think about what happens when things don't work out. And see if we can understand the difference between a vertical morality and a horizontal morality by asking how they deal with the problem of criminality. So Hegel's thought is we should think of criminal law as criminal justice is simply moral justice institutionalized. And it simply expresses the ordinary logic of Kantian morality in an institutional setting, because obviously the law is a series of universal things that everyone should obey. Some people break the law, trespass, transgress, and then we have to figure out what we're going to do. And what we're going to do is we're going to punish them. Punishment represents the authority of the law in just those cases where its authority has been defied. It is the claim of authority against its abrogation. Well, Hegel wants to suggest, and he actually agrees with this, and it's Kant's thought, let me say where I'm going. Adam was asking me, your fancy new morality without ought. What do you do with bad guys? What do you do with the immoral person? Hegel's thought is punishment is not what we do. It's our admission that there is nothing we can do. Punishment is our human expression that if someone breaks the law, we have no resources to hand. So that all we can do with a lawbreaker, and I'm going to say all we can do, and according to the logic of law, we must do, is punish them. But punish them is really a putting scarecrows around it. Get rid of them. And I'm saying, for that kind of law, we must get rid of them. Or, now I'll just put all my cards on the table, every punishment is simply a version of the death penalty. The death penalty is not an accident. It is the essence of punishment. There can be no punishment without the thought of the death penalty. That's Hegel's argument. Well, why? Well, I've already suggested that to do an act is to make yourself a legislator. That is, each human, so if you do a criminal act, you have asserted your law against the law of the state. So you have set yourself in place of the state. So you have claimed that the authority of the state is nil, and that your law is the true law. That's what every criminal action does. It asserts its law is true law. Therefore, if we actually believe in our law, then we must find a way of canceling or negating the legislative authority of the criminal act. And acts are particular things, right? They're, someone steals an apple. That's just one act. How do we undo one act? Well, we can't undo one act. The problem is not the act. It's the actor. It's you who stole the apple. You're the problem. Because you have made yourself a universal legislator against our law. So what we must do, clearly, is get rid of you. That is, we must put you to death, because only by putting you to death do we demonstrate that the law is the law. If we leave you hanging around, then we're leaving hanging around someone who is claiming to be, right, another law against our law. And you say, wait a minute. I apologize. I know you apologize. I apologize. We don't. Why on earth should we believe anyone who breaks the law, who says they are the law, who claims to be a law against all of us, that no, they're really one of us? Once you have made yourself a legislator, you have put yourself outside all possible community, and therefore, you must be put to death. It's the law of the state. It's us. We are the laws of the state simply are the representation of our beliefs and will. That's who we are. That's all this state is. So to act against the law is to act against everyone.
So if we're moving away from the king or the ruler, that would define the majority of the inhabitants?
Never majority. It's everyone. Every law. Majority decisions are mechanisms for deciding who we are. They're just mechanisms. The law always represents everyone. Majority or minority, doesn't matter whether you voted for it or against it. If you live in a democracy, the law represents all.
But it's everyone but you.
But yeah, exactly. That's why we have to get rid of it. Tough night. Yeah.
But I'm just saying that you could obviously be 10 or 200. So, I mean, in a way, we are dealing with the mechanisms of the majority against the one or the 100.
Until the moment of revolution comes, which is why the notion of revolution can never be part of the law, that even if everyone, if we've agreed to this form of life, then the law does represent us. This is why when my country does terrible things in Iraq, I'm full of shame. It's not because I willed it or the majority willed it. It's because I willed that war. When my country goes to war, I have willed it. Otherwise, I'm not a citizen. We are implicated in every action of our government. Otherwise, there is no government. Always. It's always universal. Nothing to do with majority and minority. That has nothing to do with the logic of law. As Arendt says over and over again, majoritarian thinking is a mechanism for reaching decisions, not the authority itself. The authority is the form of life to live according to laws.
No one does this better than Rousseau.
So it's about the laws, not about the mechanisms for establishing them, which is why even in quasi-tyrannical states, people can be affronted by criminals. Nonetheless, the law represents them. And the people we're reading about, Kant and all these people, of course, took it for granted. They were not Democrats. They took it that the monarch represented the universal, that it represented everyone. And they just took that as obvious. They didn't see democracy as a magical way of getting to law. So it's the thought of law. That's why this is about law, not about majority decisions, not about everyone. It's about the form of life to live in accordance with law and what that means. This is very important. This is actually important about politics, too. And I think this is right, by the way. About that I do think that's my, I'm a mad dog Republican, so I can think more strongly than that. But I think on any account of living according to law, we must think that. Never, the law never has anything to do with the majority. It's the state and its citizens. That is what it represents. Yeah.
Just so I'm clear, so this concept of punishment for the criminal completely negates any possibility for something like rehabilitation in prison or something like that, right? I'm just on pragmatic level.
That doesn't eliminate it. It only shows that it's a form of quibbling. It doesn't eliminate anything. It just shows what the logic is, and that the logic of punishment is not accidental to the idea of law. Now, Hegel does want a different logic. And he wants to think of punishment not in terms of what the state does, because, by the way, he thinks he will actually defend punishment. I mean, he says, you know, criminals deserve to be punished. He has a real retributionist theory of punishment. But he says that, and this is the point that I'm trying to get at now, he's been saying that, and this is all just Abraham and Isaac all over again, right? I'm just saying what it is to have a universal law, to believe that it is a law, and what it is to sacrifice the individual to the authority of that law. This is about the logic of authority of the law. Now, what happens, so that's punishment is inevitable. Hegel says what's not inevitable is now, very Micah's just question, is the execution of the punishment. Now, for law, Hegel says absolutely and unequivocally, the criminal must be punished. If, he says, page 227, there is no way of making the action undone. If its reality is eternal in supplanting the law, then no reconciliation is possible, not even through suffering punishment. That's why death is the only thing. Suffering punishment doesn't do anything. This is a question of authority we're all thinking about. And what I must do is get rid of the competing source of authority, namely the other legislative will, the criminal. Is there another way of thinking about it? Well, his answer is punishment not as law, but as fate. And he says this is different than penal law. And this is, again, not an answer to the story about penal law, but as I said in the first lecture, what Hegel must convince us is not logically to get somewhere else, but to learn how to change the topic, learn how to change the conversation. And his attempt to change the conversation happens on page 229. It is arguably the most beautiful passage in all of Hegel. And it is, I think, the clue to his entire philosophy. So I'm relieved that I got there. Clue. Only through a departure from united life, which is neither regulated by law nor at variance with law. Stop there. We've already suggested that life is a synthesis of inclination and law. So the idea of life here is not a norm of which other things can correspond to or fail to correspond to be accord with or be at variance with. So he wants to say, wait a minute. And here I want to be clear what he's worried about. If we're going to change the topic, we have to rethink what we mean by transgression and trespass. So what he's beginning to do here is try to get another model of what, let's call it, wrongness is. Because unless we know what wrongness is, we won't know what punishment involves. Only through a departure from united life, this, you know, the community as a unit, union of union and non-union, which is neither regulated by law nor at variance with law, our togetherness. Think of a family or a couple. We're together, right? And whatever our togetherness is, it doesn't make sense to say we're either in accord with the law or not. I mean, that's not what love is, right? That just gets it wrong. So he's trying to say people can be together in their relationships, bound up together, united, without the notion of either being. So the notion of law, he's trying to make us think, is a red herring, right? For thinking about a different form of, let's call it, human connectedness. Or what is clearly Hegel's topic, the nature of the human social bond, how we are connected up. And that is the mystery that he's going to try to solve, how human beings are connected to one another. And the one thing he's trying to get us at least to think might be possible is not by laws. And not by mere sentiment either. Right? Not by mere sentiment. Shall I try reading that phrase one more time? See, it's hard to get through these sentences. Only through a departure from united life, which is neither regulated by law nor at variance with law, only through the killing of life is something alien produced. So now we're starting from this model of a united life, and we're saying that what makes something alien, what's the model of making something alien, is killing it. That's one way of removing it from our midst, making it alien. Destruction of life. And now he says something that's almost a contradiction in terms, except he's gambling his entire philosophical future that it's not. Destruction of life is not the nullification of of life. Which sounds weird, right? It sounds like the destruction of life is not the destruction of life. And he can't be quite saying that. So he must say that killing one life is not killing all life. Killing one life is not killing my connectedness with the other, not fully undoing that connectedness, but rather, and now we're going to get just one of those words that are like impossible to swallow, it's diremption. To diremt is to cut in half, to separate, to pull apart, to pull into two, right? But it's a violent act of twoing, of making two what was one. And the destruction consists in its transformation into an enemy. The illusion of trespass, the illusion of the killer, the illusion of the murderer, the illusion of that who strikes out against life, its belief that it destroys the other life and thinks itself enlarged thereby. This is the hope of every murderer. Otherwise, no one would ever murder. Kill you. I remove the obstacle in my way, and I am enlarged thereby. So the other is obstacle, is difficulty, is what stands in my way, is what makes me limited and finite, and therefore, if I think the other is my limit and makes me finite, then the only thing I need in order to expand, and we all want to expand, is to kill. That's the logic of murder. That's the belief of the murderer. The inevitable belief. Otherwise, those Sunnis and Shiites would not be murdering one another the way they are. They think the other's getting in their way. And they feel that each death, each beheading, they are enlarged by. Which is why we feel ourselves unable to know how to intervene. How do you tell someone? Roxy.
Is that not exactly the reverse of love, logic
love? Oh, yes. That's right. Except, of course, what we want to say here is, and he wants to convince us that this is an illusory logic. This is the gamble. And it's what I've just said about a margin. He says this is the false belief. So it is dissipated by the fact that the disembodied spirit of the injured life comes on the scene against the trespass, just as Banquo, who came as a friend to Macbeth, was not blotted out when he was murdered, but immediately thereafter took his seat, not as a guest at the feast, but as an evil spirit. You ever write one sentence that good, I'll give you a PhD. All that just to get to the last clause, just as Banquo. The trespasser intended to have to do away with another's life, but he has only destroyed his own. His life is not different from life, since life dwells in a single Godhead. In his arrogance, he has destroyed indeed not only the friendliness of life, he has perverted life into an enemy. I want to unpack that, and the unpacking will be partial. And the unpacking will be partial again because Hegel doesn't, the logic of this is what he's committed to. This is the causality of fate that I mentioned last week. And Hegel thinks that something like this must be true. That's his metaphysical gamble. Something like this story must be true, and he has to figure out how it can be true. And in this context, what's carrying all the weight is this notion of united life. We now know that Godhead just means united life. So the thought here that he's struggling with is that human beings are interconnected with one another in ways we cannot even spell out, in ways beyond our knowing and our ken. We are, in fact, almost completely ignorant of who our others are. So Judy Butler, in a series of recent writings, has been arguing, a series of really remarkable comments, that part of how we discover who our others are is by discovering who we find ourselves grieving. That when I open the newspaper and I suddenly find myself in grief over a story about a Shiite slaughter, and my experience is that of grief, I suddenly find myself connected to them in ways I don't know how. How is one of the things we have to figure out. But Hegel's thought is we are connected, bound up together. And our being bound up together, shall we say, assumes, if I can put it crudely, we are all in it together. That we can't separate our fates from the fates of others any more than two lovers can separate their fates from one another, right? So again, the model of love is being as the model of life. Using love to model the life of a community. So, the description, the correct description, he thinks, of my destruction of the other is that it doesn't enlarge me. On the contrary, what it does is destroy, and I'll just use a placeholder set of phrases, the thick web of the life world that binds us all together. And therefore makes the conditions of my life, and let's put it crudely, the necessary conditions for the possibility of my life are undermined. So in killing the other, I am actually committing an anti-transcendental act. I am undoing the necessary conditions for the possibility of my life. So instead of being enlarged, I am in some sense making my life impossible. Well, what is this notion? So how do I make it impossible? In Hegel's...
Yeah. Is that process reversible for Hegel, or is it different? When somebody does that,
it's going to be reversible. But I have to tell you, you know, you're nodding, oh yeah, good, reversible. No. If my late friend Gary Dahl was sitting there, he was saying, irreversible. That's Gary Dahl's critique of it. So we're going to get to that. This is not, none of this is unproblematic. Not a moment of it.
Which is sort of, I mean, because I'm thinking about Macbeth as we're doing this. You know, that's Macbeth. The moment he commits one murder,
he's lost.
No choice. All he can do is kill more. And he knows he's dead.
Yeah.
So murder-suicide. So the first place the word assassin is used in English, that's what an assassin is. It's when you kill someone, they're not going to get out of it.
And of course, that's a nice. All murder is suicide. That's Hegel's argument here. And how do we see this? Well, Hegel's way of seeing here is to talk about fate, and to talk about fate, he, of course, is, in his case, thinking originally about the fates in Greek tragedy. So he's thinking that literally when you break the law, these harpies are going to come and they're going to get you, right? You're going to unleash them. But he also wants to think that can't be quite the right story. He also wants to think that it's the return of the repressed. And he therefore wants to think of this in terms of the notion of guilt. So how do I know, as it were, that he thinks that necessarily, when you transgress, I want to be careful here, you suffer a fate. And the fate is that life becomes alien, right? Which is to say, you cannot get back in touch with either yourself or those others around you. That you are necessarily excluded from the life you live, no matter what you do. We don't need to throw you in prison. You are in hell. So, and the reason for this is not a matter of anything mechanical or hydraulic, although the notion of return to the repressed can look like that. In a Greek tragedy, it's a matter of plot. Right? Plot is actually another way of talking about fate. Right? Plot is just a structure of fate. That's why it's very important that the first great modern play, Hamlet, has no plot. Right? Everything had to happen without the plot. Tragedy without plot is what it's about. Because he had to discover the meaning of the impossibility of his life without relying on all the structures that were handed over to him. That he was not in any of the plays he thought he might be in. He was an individual, and therefore he had to bear up under this fate himself. So, the thought is that fate is, and I'm quoting from Hegel here, the manner of receiving and reacting against the other's deed. The example I gave in the essay, I know, simple example to get us thinking about this, over the example of trust. Think of trust as the basic condition for our ordinary life together. What I mean here is, I'm walking around here, and I ain't worried that someone's going to pull out a gun and shoot me. I have absolute unconditional, I'm not wary, I'm not looking over my shoulder. There are certain conditions of complete trust. And it's not because, and I want to be clear, this is not hard, it's not because I know that if someone do that, they would be punished. Because, you know, that's not trust, that's kind of consequence. I mean that actually we have a kind of confidence in certain settings, and in certain settings not, hence why we prefer some settings to others, that we can trust those around us. Now, I do something terrible. What about you? What about me? I do something terrible. what's the consequence of that? I have learned that at least one person in my environment is completely untrustworthy. Me. But if I can't even trust myself, if I know in my heart of hearts I am not deserving of trust, I'm going to trust you. So suddenly, by me not being trustworthy, I can no longer trust the other, and therefore, suddenly, right, I don't trust anyone. So, it's not because someone betrayed me that I don't trust. Life becomes unfriendly because I am untrustworthy. I broke the promise, killed, stole, whatever. And therefore, the friendliness of life is at an end. Well, let's see if we can reverse. What I'm suggesting here is that the problem now is the problem of diremption, of making life unfriendly, of therefore, let's say, that I've lost contact with my others who are the necessary condition for the possibility of my having a world at all. Right? So transgression makes life impossible. But trespass now is not a breaking of an abstract law. It's a modification of life. It's just that, a modification of life. And therefore, if it's a modification of life, then it must be open to further modifications. The language of modification is very important here. It's not an accident that Hegel used it. So on the part of transgressors, me, now I can do those things that you've all been dying for me to do, right? I can confess and apologize and repent and try to make reparation and go into rehabilitation and all those other things. Because why? Because there is in me, quoting Hegel, page 231, the fate in which the man senses what he has lost. Great sentence. So be real careful about what the sentence is. The fate in which the man senses what he has lost creates the longing for life, for lost life. So, notice a couple of things about the sentence. First, I don't have to sense that I've been separated from my life. I can be separated from life and not know it. Which is to say, there's such a thing as objective guilt or objective despair. Right? Secondly, it's only at the moment that I sense that I have lost something that the experience of loss is itself the longing for that lost life, even if I don't understand it that way. Right? This is why struggling with criminals can be so peculiar. Right? Because on the one hand, you know, they can suffer guilt, but they can't understand that they're longing for lost life. This longing recognizes what has been lost as life, as what was once its friend, and this recognition is already an extraordinary sentence, the enjoyment. It's the enjoyment of life, not because the guilty person is happy. It's not that kind of enjoyment. It's rather that they're in life. They're not in the throes of the moral law or the punishing superego or the man with all the power, all the ways in which we objectify the law. So suffering guilt is my acknowledgement of my answerability. And therefore pushes me toward confession apology. And if you are very nice, you will forgive. When we get there, I am going to try to convince you that forgiveness is the central metaphysical concept of Hegel's entire system. So that's 25 minutes away. Yeah.
You said that every citizen is responsible for helping make that.
Mm-hmm.
And in America, we have the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
We argue that all of us lose, as you said,
absolutely,
all connection to life.
Yeah.
Now you said that there is the option of forgiveness and asking for apology. My question would be, is there such a thing that as a communal question of all citizens of forgiveness?
It's a great question. First of all, I'll say it's a question that Professor Poole's entire course is on this semester. And therefore, it's a really hard question. So let me not answer, but let me actually make it worse. You ask, could there be collective apology and collective forgiveness? And I want to ask further, are there acts which are unforgivable? Who is to forgive? Under what conditions? Can we always go back? Or only under certain conditions? How long does guilt last? And if there is guilt that's collective, does it go down the generations? And for how long? And so on. Now, my own intuitions are always on the miserable side of all this. I take it we are guilty for slavery, that slavery is still with us, that slavery is the great wound of American civil society that has never been undone, and we have not found a way of either confessing, because we're unsure what it is we need to confess, or to find a way of making life friendly, which is to say, these are really hard questions. But they are the ones that Hegel's putting on the table as the right questions. Questions that can't even come up in the appropriate way prior to Jesus. And why it is that Christianity should be this turning point. And why it is that, and I mean Christianity just now as a cultural moment in a collective learning process, but I take it as fundamental for Hegel's thought, not just in this essay, but in the entire system, that he thinks that Christianity is, and Jesus does, change the conversation. And he's not going to change his mind about that. Now, of course, in order to suddenly expect forgiveness, I just want to say forgiveness is odd. Forgiveness is odd. I forgive you for stealing that apple. The oddness of that, am I undoing the action? Am I remaking the past? Hegel says here what he will say in the phenomenology, that I can make life friendly again and leave no wounds behind. It's awesome power. And he thinks this happens by some people saying the word, I forgive you. A speech act. I forgive you. Whatever Hegel means by the power of spirit, which is what we're going to go on to discuss next week, everything about it is connected to the speech act. I forgive you. Because that means, why is that so important? Because it means even the past is not past. You bring it all back. And therefore, even the worst thing possible is suddenly not outside us. It's brought within the ambit. And therefore, even the negative has a place within this whole. That's the idea, again, of objective idealism. Okay. Next week, we are going to start with the introduction, not the preface. Please don't read the preface. It's a waste of time. It's unreadable. Read the introduction. It's unreadable too, which is shorter. I know that some people were surprised to discover that they were in groups that have papers due today. In fact, everyone's paper was due today. You just didn't read the instructions carefully. But this is not a peace state. So if by any chance you don't have your paper, bring it in when you get it done. The idea is, though, I do want you writing so Rossio and I can hear that this is complicated. We want to know that you're going along. I hate to say this, but for those who want to hand the paper in to me, groups 1 through 4 on my right, and people who are giving it to Rossio on my left. So there's a politics here, alas. There's always a politics. And next week we'll begin with the phenomenology and the introduction.
Okay, where did the sheets go?